Hello, I'm Timothy Lim. I'm Professor of Hebrew Bible and Second Temple Judaism at the University of Edinburgh.
Dr. Timothy Lim. Timothy, good to see you. Welcome to the podcast.
Nice to see you, David. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're here in your home, and you've been gracious host to me the last few days. Thank you very much. Hey, for those who don't know Timothy Lim, who is Timothy Lim?
Well, I'm a British and Canadian scholar from a Christian and Chinese background, and I've been living in the UK for, I guess, over 30 years, and apart from biblical studies, I'm interested in all kinds of things that people don't know about, and that is that I'm interested in playing the guitar.
You are a good guitar player. I've heard it.
Oh, thank you. And I also like to go to the gym. Yeah. I go approximately 5 times a week to the gym, and I play tennis.
And this summer, you'll be heading over to where?
So in a couple of days, I'm going to Dartmouth College in New Hampshire to teach a summer course on Bible and archaeology in the Department of Religion.
And your wife will be going with you?
She'll join me once she completes her academic year. She's a teacher.
Yeah. Well, you're well known around the world as an expert in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so we want to talk today about the Dead Sea Scrolls, which have fascinated me for a long time. I don't have the linguistic skills you have in it. I can work in it, but boy, it's slow for me. But let's just start off with something very basic. What are the Dead Sea Scrolls?
So the Dead Sea Scrolls are ancient manuscripts that were discovered by the Dead Sea, in caves by the Dead Sea. And they are manuscripts that belong to a Jewish community, the Essenes, who lived in the Second Temple period, which is the period around the turning of the era or the time of Jesus, if you like.
Mm-hmm. And the scrolls themselves are books, right? What we would call a book. They used rolls for their books. We use codices or codexes for our books today. But how many books in all were there? You probably can't be exactly precise, but approximate.
That's right. So we're not precise. The estimate is between 800 to 1,000 as scrolls. And if you think about it, it's not because we're innumerate that we're in, then that's why we're in humanities, but rather because of the data and the evidence that we have. Mm. So a number of the scrolls, maybe about 20 to 25 of them, are well-preserved scrolls, but the rest of them are really fragments. And so if you think about the problems of piecing together fragments, it's akin to the task, the unenviable task of trying to put together a puzzle where you don't have the cover on the box and you're missing all kinds of pieces in the box, and somebody else has put in other pieces from another puzzle into the same box, mixing it all together.
Yeah.
And so that's the kind of challenges that we have in Dead Sea Scroll studies. And it makes it more difficult to be certain about how many scrolls we actually have.
And there's always a chance, I suppose, in putting together the puzzle that you put together a puzzle that
incorrectly
never existed.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. So you've got to be careful about that.
Yes, that's right.
And computers are being used today.
Absolutely. Using computers for digitization in order to clean up the image so they can read it better. But also trying, in some cases, to find joins. That is, if you find one piece has a particular shape on its edge and it fits the mirror image or the other side of it, and it fits into that image, and that's a join, that's a possible join to it.
So these were discovered about 70 years ago, if my math is about
that's right.
About
it's 70 just years over ago. Just over 70 years.
In 11 caves, was it, or is it?
They were discovered in 11 caves by an archaeological site called Kirbet Qumran. Kirbet means ruins of a place called Qumran, by the northwest shores of the Dead Sea. However, In recent years, there's been further discovery of a cave, which has been identified by some as Cave 12. Now, this is somewhat controversial because it comes late, but there's good evidence that it belongs to the same collection of caves 1 to 11 because it has the same kind of pottery as you find
at the Dead Sea Scroll jars.
The broken jars, uh-huh. the pottery from that are found in that particular cave as well as in the archaeological site as well as in other caves.
So any intact scrolls in that, or are they all fragmentary?
So here's the other problem, and that is that we do have a tiny little piece of scroll with no writing, but that's been prepared, that it's been lined.
Oh, okay.
So unfortunately, there's nothing written, so there's no substantial or maybe contextual link to other scrolls that we have. So the link is through proximity to Kibbutz Qumran, and also because of the discovery of the pottery. That's the same.
So what do we know about the people who wrote these, preserved these, treasured these, valued these books?
Yeah, so the scholarly consensus is that the community that owned these scrolls were a Jewish group known as the Essenes. And the Essenes are a small community. I think both Philo and Josephus talks about them as having 4,000 members. So at the very beginning of Qumran scholarship, that is at the beginning of when they discovered it in 1947 and forward, the reigning hypothesis was that these Essenes basically lived at Kibbutz Qumran. Nowadays, there's a change in the understanding of where they lived, and that Qumran is only one place. And there are lots of other places that, in fact, Josephus talks about them living in all places in Judea.
And that's the southern part of what we today call Israel.
That's right. So we even have evidence that the Essenes also lived in Jerusalem.
And the Essenes had a particular way of looking at the world that was distinct from other Jews. They seemed to be apocalyptic, I guess you could say. And the way they treasured their Bibles, the way they read their Bibles, were very unique.
Yes, that's right. So I think that the Essenes had an understanding of the world as dualistic. It's often described as being ethical dualism. That is, the world is clearly divided between the wicked and the righteous. And obviously, they're the righteous, and they're the ones who will be saved. And they will be saved because of their belief in God as interpreted by their leaders, including the teacher of righteousness.
Yeah, he lived when? Do we know exactly or approximately when the teacher of righteousness lived?
We don't know. In fact, there's some debate as to whether that's actually just a title. That the teacher of righteousness is a title for various individuals.
So they, like dean of the school.
Exactly. Okay. But at the very beginning of Dead Sea Scroll studies, the teacher of righteousness was considered to be somebody who was a teacher who operated in the second century BCE. That is, in the middle of the second century, during the time of the Maccabees. That's when he operated, and his opponent was somebody who's called by another epithet, the wicked priest. And that wicked priest was identified as Jonathan Maccabee or Simon Maccabee, two Maccabean, Hasmonean priests and rulers. But nowadays, it's changed. The Qumran scholarship has really changed, and the emerging consensus is that it is the origins of the Qumran community is not in the middle of the second century, but actually in the first century, at the time when the Romans entered into Judea and took it over. So when Pompey conquered Judea and entered Jerusalem, that was 63 BCE.
So that would be the origins of the community, and that community lasted until...
So the evidence that we have archaeologically is that the Qumran was destroyed by the Romans in the conflagration that was the first Jewish revolt. And so that would be between 66 and 70, when the Romans burnt down the temple, went around and also sacked Galilee before that, and then went
the city on after to, city, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And Qumran was one of the fortresses. In fact, the following archaeological period showed that they made Qumran into a Roman lookout.
Because of its high point.
Yeah, that's right.
You can see up and down the right. sea. Anybody that might be coming,
that's
any
right.
troublemakers from their point of view.
Yes, that's right. So they didn't need a number of things in the Qumran site, like the ritual bathing pools any longer, so that those became obsolete and they only used certain parts of it.
So the scrolls were left there on purpose, or was it an accident? Why do you think they were left there?
Again, there are many theories about how the scrolls were left in the caves. One theory is that they were sequestered. They were taken from libraries in Jerusalem and sequestered or taken away for safety in the Judean desert. And they were hidden there during the war between the Jews and the Romans in the first century. So that's one theory. Mm. Another one is that this place, the Kibbutz Qumran, with its caves, was a kind of a geniza. Mm. A geniza in Hebrew means that it's like a storeroom. So you have that quite often in synagogues, where used manuscripts or scrolls that have been used are not destroyed, but placed in the storeroom to dissipate on its own. Mm. Because of the fact that you're not allowed to destroy something that has the name of God in it. In fact, Orthodox Judaism has two ways of disposing of such scrolls. One is to put it in a geniza to let it decompose on its own. Mm-hmm. Or the other one is to dig up and bury it. Those are the two ways.
Give it a proper burial then. in that way, I suppose.
Yeah.
So what have the Dead Sea Scrolls told us about Jews and Judaism that we didn't know?
Okay. So the scrolls have told us quite a lot of things about Judaism, or what we call early Judaism. Mm. And one of the most fascinating things that we've learned from this is the connection, what I would call a sectarian matrix, that is the subset of the wider society of Second Temple Judaism, where these sects, and sectarians, by the way, should not be thought of in this negative way, mm-hmm. but rather this is the sectarians are more like schools of mm-hmm. philosophy. Mm-hmm. Right? They have specific teachings mm-hmm. that make them distinctive, but they're not
odd or wild or way
exactly.
out there.
Right? Yes, exactly. Yeah. So the sectarians is a sectarian matrix. They include the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Essenes, the Therapeutae, and followers of Jesus as well. That's the kind of matrix that emerges very clearly.
Could you include in there the followers of John the Baptist?
Yes. In fact, John the Baptist was seen by some in Qumran scholarship as the link between the Essenes and the earliest followers of Jesus. Because in Mark, John the Baptist is introduced by a passage in Isaiah 40, chapter verse 3, about a voice calling in the wilderness. And that same biblical passage is also found in the rule of the community as a proof text for the that justify the Qumran community living in the desert.
So let's talk about the Hebrew Bible now.
Okay.
Of those 800 scrolls to 1,000 scrolls.
Right.
One of the things discovered there have been books that we today find in the Hebrew Bible, but are also now in the Christian scriptures, part one of the Christian
yeah.
scriptures
yeah.
called the Old Testament.
Yeah.
Have they told us anything new about those biblical books?
Ah, okay. So, yes, indeed. And the two things that I would outline. The first is that the biblical text, if we just take it that, like Genesis, Exodus, etc. So we have in the Qumran collection all the books that became canonical, except for the Book of Esther. Okay, so that's one thing to note. The second thing is that we discovered that the scrolls, that is these writings of the Hebrew Bible, had a variety and a fluidity about them that is not evident later on. So if we think about the Hebrew Bible, we think about the Hebrew Bible that was created by the Masoretes. And that Masoretic text is one version of the Hebrew Bible, or one end of each book of the Hebrew Bible. And that became either fixed or selected as the authoritative text by 100 CE.
Really? Okay.
After 100 CE, every single text that we find in the Judean desert is a proto-Masoretic text. Before that, there's a great deal more fluidity as to what kind of version that you have.
So, why Esther? Why is Esther not one of those books? Is there any thoughts about
Yeah, I was going to say $60,000 question, but
that?
it's probably now $1 billion question. So,
Inflation.
yeah,
Inflation,
inflation,
yeah.
yeah. So there are several theories about that. And one theory is that it because the Book of Esther doesn't include the name of God, it doesn't refer to God. So that's one possibility to say that, well, it's secular
The
and
name of God is not found in that
is not
book.
found in that
And
book, in
even a
that book.
reference just to God in general, like Elohim,
Yes,
is
that's
not
right.
found.
But there's an issue there is that, of course, the Septuagint in its expansion of the Book of Esther then includes all kinds of things to God. So that's one possible reason, and it's been speculated that that's
That
it.
may
But
be
we
it.
just don't know.
Yeah.
We really don't know why the Book of Esther is not there. And it's interesting too because it's not so much the nature of the Book of Esther, because the Book of Esther is about court tales in the Persian court. And so we have court tales in the Persian court in Qumran. That's not Esther.
Not the Book of Esther.
Yeah. So that's not the reason.
Right. That ends part one of my discussion with Dr. Timothy Lim from the University of Edinburgh. We're going to continue this conversation about the Dead Sea Scrolls on the Stone Chapel.